he had become unresponsive and syncopized on the field.
Either delirium, seizure, or just abject coma.
Permanent neurologic deficit happens in nearly 1 out of 5 patients.
The body can no longer auto-regulate and just can't keep up.
The longer these patients stay hot, the more downstream effects we'll see.
We've got to get these patients cooled.
We had a giant ice coffin.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. And welcome to one of our July 2018 podcasts. I'm so happy that many of you are joining us, and a big welcome to all of our new PGY1 residents in emergency medicine, those in internal medicine listening across the U.S. that just got started at the end of June, beginning of July, and also a big hello and welcome to all of the critical care fellows listening in across the country that have just started their fellowship. We are so excited to have you joining us here on Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Lots of great topics. We got a lot of things to talk about over the next 6 months here in 2018. And really, to get us started, we are going to start off with a very timely topic, as certainly those of us in the U.S. and the Northern Hemisphere are battling the heat and humidity. We're going to talk a little bit about heat stroke today. But before we delve into that education, let me bring in and say a quick hi to my three stellar co-hosts, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how are you this month?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Mike. Happy to be here.
Likewise, doing very, very well.
Things in Philadelphia are great. Definitely looking forward to a new class of critical care and emergency medicine trainees. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Lots of fun indeed. And John, actually, you brought us this topic this month, so I'm going to turn the mic over to you to take us through and MC our agenda for this podcast.
All right. So again, a timely topic. So we're going to introduce this more or less as a patient who I had the opportunity to initially take care of a few years back. So it was a hot summer day. It was in the middle of July, actually, which kind of reminded me about the topic. There was an overhead phone call by EMS alerting us to a patient who was going to be brought to our emergency department. And the call was essentially this. It was a 20-year-old male who was en route about 5 minutes out, who was brought from a football field during practice. And I don't know about you guys, but whenever you get a call and you hear a young age, particularly of a found down or something, you definitely take a little bit of pause. Say 20, and sure enough, it was a 20-year-old. He was actually in the middle of his second workout of the day. So he was actually from a local college, and they were doing their two-a-day workouts. And it was a hot day, but after about an hour and a half into his workout, he had become unresponsive and syncopized on the field. So the coaches ran out and they called 911, and the initial vital signs when they got there was he was tachycardic, heart rate in the 150s with a blood pressure about 80 over palp. By the time he got to us, it was about 5 minutes in, initial set of vital signs were temperature 105, his heart rate was in the high 140s, blood pressure was 85 over 45. He was tachypneic and sitting 96%. He was altered, confused, and really more somnolent than anything else. His airway was intact, but obviously appeared ill. We did a quick resuscitation ultrasound that showed an underfilled right ventricle and left ventricle. It was pretty hyperdynamic and a completely flat IVC. On secondary exam, he was dry. His extremities were completely dry. His skin was dry and cool, particularly in the peripheries, but he definitely felt warm around the chest and was hot. We got a quick set of labs sent off and started our initial resuscitation, but obviously concerning things that came back were a CPK of around 200,000, a creatinine of 5. He had evidence of acute liver injury with a T-bili that was slightly elevated around 2, but his AST and ALT were in the 2000s, and a potassium of 5.8. So I think we're obviously concerned, you know, Occam's razor putting all together that this young man was in pretty bad shape, likely from excessive exercise in the heat. And this was a serious case of heat stroke. And as we take a pause in terms of the case, but look more about heat stroke in general, in the U.S. alone, there's about 3,300 deaths that have been reported from heat stroke between 2006 and 2010. In fact, the CDC reports that about 650 deaths per year are attributed directly to excessive heat exposure. Now, interestingly, a large number of these are elderly patients who don't have air conditioning in their house or are outside. And most of them actually occur in urban areas, particularly in the homeless population, are a very vulnerable population here. The concerning thing and the unfortunate part about this is the outcomes are pretty bad. Once you get into this heat stroke type state and you've gone to kind of the end stage of environmental heat exposure, mortality is pretty high. So 1 month mortality is up to 60%, and permanent neurologic deficit happens in nearly 1 out of 5 patients. So as we're trying to wrap our head around this patient and around the concern for the diagnosis, Peter, why don't you walk us through a little bit more about heat stroke in general and sort of the diagnosis as well as some of the presentation issues?
Sure. Happy to, because this is a great case. But as you said, you know, this case with the exertional component of it, typically young of age, but the ones that we see most frequently are elderly. So that kind of sets two different groups apart. But when we talk about really the definition of heat stroke, most people use a core body temperature of greater than 40 degrees Celsius. Typically, particularly in the elderly group, skin will be hot and dry. Patients with heat exhaustion will still sweat and have no organ dysfunction, but that's really not heat stroke. When we talk about heat stroke, it's typically these elevated temperatures associated with CNS abnormalities. So either delirium, seizure, or just abject coma. It's interesting because in Japan, they use an alternative definition, and this is based on several fatal cases of heat stroke that presented with a core temperature in excess of 40. And there, patients exposed to high environmental temperatures who met one or more of the following criteria. One was central nervous system manifestation. Again, GCS less than 14, cerebellar symptoms, frank seizure, and then hepatic renal dysfunction. This is either creatinine or total bilirubin in excess of 1.2. So it doesn't seem crazy high for us, but in association with heat exposure, this is a big deal. And then also coagulation abnormalities and disorders. And this looks like a DIC picture. And it can really result from environmental temperature exposure or strenuous exercise. And so again, when we think about the case that John presented to us earlier, that's exertional. And the exertional typically exposure to heat, young people, they will still be hot temperatures, lots of sweating, and they tend to be the more severe rhabdo, severe renal injury, elevated lactate. And on the sugar side, they tend to be hypoglycemic. And that gets differentiated from the elderly who, again, tend to be dry, still high temperatures. Their bumps in liver and renal tend to be less so than exertional. Their lactate less so, but their blood sugar tends to be elevated. So that's what we tend to see. And then DIC can be seen in both worse in exertional, the younger people. But I would pass this off to Rob to lead us through the pathophys.
Thanks, Peter. So moving on to the pathophysiology behind heat stroke, there are a number of physiologic mechanisms that lead to this problem. First and primary are problems with thermoregulation. And as you mentioned, these patients, as their temperature rises, they develop cutaneous vasodilatation that leads to sweating and volume loss. And over time, if cooling measures aren't enacted or if this is not addressed, the body's thermoregulation just can't keep up. The ability to sweat diminishes. Blood is shunted away from the viscera in order to go to the skin. And this can result in other damage and other organ failure. There are some observational studies that suggest that the critical thermal maximum in human bodies is a body temperature of about 41.6 to 42 degrees centigrade. And this can be tolerated anywhere from 45 minutes to maybe 8 hours. But after that point, the body can no longer autoregulate and just can't keep up. And at extreme temperatures in the high 40 degrees centigrade range, all cellular structures are destroyed and cellular necrosis occurs in less than 5 minutes. So one of the first primary mechanisms is problems with thermoregulation. And when blood is circulated away from the gut and shunted away, the gut goes into a sort of a shock state, very similar to what happens in sepsis. And this leads to the gut releasing endotoxins into the systemic circulation and precipitating what really is, by all practical purposes, a SIRS, or a SIRS phenomenon, just like in sepsis. And the degree to which that organ injury takes place is really how long those endotoxins are released and how long it takes to cool the body down. Additionally, there's capillary microthrombosis, which is caused by endothelial injury. And platelets get activated and you develop thrombocytopenia from platelet consumption and eventually wind up getting into a full-blown DIC type picture. But again, this capillary microthrombosis exacerbates the situation, causes further organ injury. And as you can see, it's sort of very much sepsis-like in that one process feeds upon another and it becomes a vicious cycle. In terms of circulatory failure, this occurs in about 20 to 65% of patients. And this largely initially occurs from hypovolemia, from sweating and sort of a dehydration type picture, but additionally occurs because of blood flow shunting from the periphery and also from the microthrombosis that occurs as well. And it's important to be aware of a couple of risk factors and a couple of other phenomena that are most notable in athletes. And if athletes, for example, are taking stimulants like amphetamines or ephedra or other stimulants, this can increase the brain's set point and place athletes at higher risk for hyperthermia. And ephedra itself may increase the activation of dopaminergic receptors and impair heat dissipation through vasoconstriction. So again, there are a variety of pathophysiologic mechanisms. It all comes down to heat injury and the body's inability to keep up with that heat accumulation, leading to SIRS and eventually sometimes an ARDS type picture.
So that's really interesting, Rob. So if I kind of can put this together in my head, you're almost treating, you know, in the early stages as hypovolemia, but then it becomes more or less a septic type picture with the end organ dysfunction, end organ injury. Now, it's interesting that you talk about stimulants. So unfortunately, it turned out with this patient here, he was on some medications for ADHD, which were basically amphetamine based. And it actually seems like this is a widely abused medication, particularly in college, and athletes will use it as a stimulant, essentially, which he was using as well. So basically, your brain says, oh, your body temperature can go higher before you sweat. And I think that might have contributed a little bit here. So it's interesting that you bring up definitely important point about the stimulants. So Mike, moving forward, so we have this patient in front of you, this really sick young individual. Walk us through how you would go about resuscitating this patient, particularly in the early stages.
Absolutely. And I think the big take-home message is we've got to get these patients cooled. In fact, we got to get them cooled most commonly through active cooling methods with the goal of reducing that core body temperature below 40, really as soon as possible. Once we get a little bit lower, down around 38, 39, we can go slower. But one of our primary objectives, especially when we've confirmed this diagnosis, is really to get them cool below 40 degrees Celsius. And there's a number of methods that can be used to cool these patients. I think importantly, none of these methods have been shown to be superior when compared to any other methods. And we've got a lot of listeners around the world, so practicing in various resource settings. Key point, just that none have actually been shown to be superior. So what are the different methods that you can cool these patients? Well, certainly I think we've all heard of, read, and used evaporation, where we've used maybe cold water blankets or sprayed some tepid water on patients and then used fans to try and cool them down. You can do a little bit more active internal cooling, and that maybe via bladder lavage. Perhaps rectal lavage is not something I've ever done, more the bladder lavage, and then also gastric lavage with cold fluids. There are intravascular cooling devices, intravascular cooling systems, and we're most used to that in the setting of targeted temperature management in a post-arrest setting. But nonetheless, these catheters can be used to cool patients quickly. Surface cooling systems, and there are a number of commercial products, won't necessarily name those brands, but you've got surface cooling devices. And then I think the one that's probably most commonly cited as the method that rapidly gets them down is really ice water immersion. So if we can get that started early, if you have that capability, if you have those resources, it can really reduce or lower body temperature by about 0.5 degrees Celsius, really within the first few minutes. Now, as we know, you can't really monitor the patients that well from a cardiovascular standpoint once you put them in a tub of ice, but that's frequently cited across the literature as probably the method to quickly get them below 40. I think in my practice, we've typically used surface cooling systems most commonly, and every now and then an intravascular cooling system or device if we have that within the ED. And then after that, probably more internal cooling with bladder lavage, gastric lavage. But I think our most common method is surface cooling systems. Peter, how about you in New Orleans? What method do you utilize?
Right. So 30 years ago in Charity Hospital, we had a giant ice coffin. It was plastic lined thing that looked like a coffin. And we used to dump patients in that thing with ice water. And then I would say probably about 15 to 20 years ago, we switched over to just ice water and fan. That's what we stuck with. We really haven't embraced internal devices or more invasive devices. We found that if you get the patient naked and then kind of spritz them with water and have the fans going, their temps drop pretty quickly.
And Rob, what about on the West Coast at UCSF? Which method are you using?
Pretty much the same as both of you indicated. We primarily start off with ice while we're getting the cooling blanket arranged and cool intravenous fluids. We also tend to stay away from invasive methods because, as Peter alluded, these methods work very, very well if you just get them going right away. So we're not typically putting in chest tubes or doing other things like that. Again, primarily surface cooling, either with ice and fans, followed by cooling blankets.
And John?
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, we've embraced the wet blankets, particularly in ice packs. So we'll put a patient on the monitor. We have these big white cotton blankets that will be used whether it's summer or winter. But it's not a bad idea to just wet one of those big cotton blankets, put it on top, and then start the fan. It actually brings people's temperature down really quick. The imagery of my mind of an ice coffin, Peter, is just unbelievable. But, you know, I think the logistics of putting someone in a tub of water in the hospital is probably a little bit different than if you're on the sideline, particularly if you're volunteering for a high school or something like that, and one of your kids drops, to get them into ice water while you're waiting for EMS is probably a great solution. Or if you're in a little bit resource-limited areas. You know, the Arctic Sun pads are fairly expensive, and I think that you can get a pretty good effect with ice packs, iced IV fluids that you'd use for TTM, and a cold blanket.
Well, John, you had asked about other resuscitation or management things, and I think the biggest thing certainly is cooling it. We're all on board with that. And once again, your goal temperature is really to get them below 40 degrees Celsius as soon as possible. There's a few other things that have come up and sometimes intuitively make sense. So antipyretics, you know, in someone who is markedly hyperthermic, actually they're not recommended. So your acetaminophen doesn't really appear to be useful and in some cases may even exacerbate organ injury. Similarly, dantrolene is commonly thought of to be given, and that, once again, just like an antipyretic, really isn't recommended in the treatment of heat stroke. For patients who have seizures or are shivering, then certainly thinking of benzodiazepines would be very appropriate. But for the most part, seizures, if they have them, tend to be due to metabolic disturbances and really not epileptiform foci, or they're not epileptic. So in general, anti-epileptic therapies really aren't beneficial in patients with heat stroke. John, you had mentioned, and in summarizing Rob's pathophysiology, this is very similar to things that go wrong in the setting of sepsis. And in terms of hemodynamic cardiovascular resuscitation, we're going to provide them with fluids. Not much in the way of the heat stroke, heat exhaustion literature regarding normal saline versus balanced. I think depending on the patient's laboratory abnormalities, we'd err on the side of a balanced fluid choice for resuscitated fluids. You're going to be aggressive with fluids. Most often the hypotension is due more to a distributive form of shock. But as patients may develop renal insufficiency, renal failure due to rhabdomyolysis, you're going to have to pay attention to the amount of fluid that you are providing these folks. In terms of that renal dysfunction, there is some literature and reports to say that maybe early continuous renal replacement therapy, so CRRT, may help in reducing 30-day mortality. This is limited primarily to observational studies and still somewhat controversial. And in terms of hepatic dysfunction, this is a frequent end organ dysfunction in the setting of heat stroke, hepatic necrosis, once again due to elevated temperatures. There is a therapy called MARS, or it's more so extracorporeal liver therapy. Think of this as dialysis for the liver. It's certainly gaining popularity in a lot of hepatic failure conditions. Not a whole lot in the heat stroke literature, the heat exhaustion type of literature. So it may be something in terms of patients who are progressing and have hepatic necrosis, hepatic failure, to consider and discuss with your critical care colleagues. But by far and away, the big, big take-home point, once again, is aggressive cooling. Get them below 40 degrees Celsius. You have a number of methods to choose from, and certainly that's going to be based on what your resources are.
Excellent review, Mike. And I think that really focusing on the primary problem is most important. You know, early resuscitation with fluids, that vasodilatory response, and cooling them to a temperature of 40 as fast as possible is critical. So for our patient who came in, we did actively and aggressively externally cool him, and it took a little bit of time to get him down. So it was definitely about an hour before we got his core body temperature down to under 40. But unfortunately, some significant amount of damage had already been done. He had pretty bad rhabdo, developed acute renal failure, and some pretty significant acute liver injury that over the course of the next month or so, eventually, fortunately, he recovered, but needless to say, required renal replacement therapy for a little while. His kidneys did recover over the course of 6 months or so, but definitely a rocky course. So heat stroke in general, I mean, it's definitely something that we need to be aggressive about early on, because the longer these patients stay hot, the more downstream effects we'll see. So definitely something as we come into the July, August, September, the really hot months across the United States and elsewhere, to really keep a keen eye out for as we're working our ED and resuscitation shifts.
Outstanding, John. Thanks for leading us through a great and very timely discussion here on heat stroke. Lots of good pearls that everyone had throughout that discussion. If any of the listeners out there have any questions for us, please shoot us an email through the website. We will post a handout with this podcast and look forward to interacting with you and all of your questions. And send us your cases. Send us examples, some things that you had that may have been a little bit more innovative or perhaps cutting edge, things that we may not have talked about here on the podcast. We'd love to hear your perspective and thoughts on this very timely and critical condition. Now, as we wrap up this podcast, just a few things to look forward to on the horizon. We've got some great educational content that will be coming really for the remainder of the year. We're excited to get these podcasts out to you. The website continues to evolve. So, as you know, we switched over to www.criticalcareinem.com. Let us know what additional features you'd like to see and what things are of value to you on the website from CCPEM. Some upcoming conferences. We've got the Crashing Patient here in Baltimore. That's October 9th through the 11th. Just a wonderful conference here, led, actually founded and put on by Dr. Amal Mattu here in Baltimore, Maryland. Peter, we've got Critical Points. That is the first weekend in December. Is that correct?
Yep, so it'll be December 1st and 2nd and the last day of November. So come join us out in lovely San Diego.
Outstanding resort out there. Is it the Rancho Bernardo, correct?
Yeah, Rancho Bernardo.
They've really got a wonderful place during the holiday season. So awesome, awesome conferences. And Peter, the website that people can go to?
Criticalpoints.net.
And then you can see all of the faculty, the agenda, and register there on the website. So great conferences ahead. Look to the Crashing Patient here in Baltimore. Look to Critical Points in San Diego right around the holiday time. Once again, this is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. And on behalf of Peter, Rob, John, and myself, we'll bring this podcast to a close and look forward to talking to you next time. Bye for now.